Teaching meditation can be a deeply rewarding experience. Help others improve their mental and emotional well-being, reduce stress, improve focus, increase self-awareness and self-regulation, all while deepening your own practice and understanding. Join acclaimed author, Buddhist teacher, and Emmy Award-winning musician David Nichtern on Tuesday, May 28th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time for a free online discussion on teaching meditation in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern on May 28th.
I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Server Member Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Server Member Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/innerAcademy.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hey everyone, it's Raghu. I'm back with Mind Rolling. Got a special series coming up here, which is why I'm doing this little intro. And December 22nd last year, Ram Dass left us. And I decided I wanted to get with a few of his friends, our friends, particularly Jack Kornfield, Sharon Salzberg, and Joseph Goldstein, and just chat with them about their experiences meeting Ram Dass and throughout the years, the ways in which they came together with him. Some beautiful stories. I'm so happy to share this. I really am. And so first up is going to be Jack, and then Sharon, and then Joseph over 3 weeks, just over this period of time that Ram Dass left last year. And that's my little commemoration on Mind Rolling. But also, I want to let you know that on December 22nd at 3 p.m. Pacific time, we have a program honoring Ram Dass that's presented by Love Server Member Foundation and Neem Karoli Baba Hanuman Ashram in Taos. And it is a benefit to support the Taos Ashram as they are closed and really could use the support. So all donations that you make will go exclusively to the ashram in Taos. So this program will have several movies. One is this wonderful film called Evolution of a Yogi that was done in the late 60s into 1970 at Ram Dass's father's farm in New Hampshire. And then we just finished a film called Moments of Joy and Wisdom. It's Ram Dass in Maui over the years, over these last 15, 16 years. Wonderful, poignant moments, and a lot of moments with the people that he, teachers and friends that he worked with over the years, many of whom you have seen on Be Here Now Network and or heard on Be Here Now Podcast Network, as well as seen in various movies and other events that we have put on, workshops and so on ramdas.org. And it's you know, just really poignant vignettes of Ram Dass in Maui. I think you're going to love it. I loved working on it. It just brought me back into that enormous heart of Ram Dass. So we have that. We have Krishnadas is going to be doing some chanting and talking a little bit with me and Mirabai Bush. And then we've got Rameshwar Das, who wrote this with Ram Dass, this wonderful memoir that's coming out on January 12th. Called Being Ram Dass. Go to beingramdass.com, by the way, and please pre-order the book. It'll help us a lot in terms of making more of a presence, particularly on Amazon. And when you go to this site, you'll be able to see read excerpts and see wonderful pictures. There's some great little audio bits of Ram Dass and a way in which to share your own experience with Ram Dass over the years and what he meant to you. It's a wonderful website, and happy to present this program. Now, the program, the Neem Karoli Baba movie, which it will end with, is this great, great footage from India of Maharaji and different places that he was and interviews and so on, done by Jupna Tulsi. That will only be available a couple of days after following the movie. Following the program, honoring Ram Dass on the 22nd. The other movies will be available at least for a week or two. I'm not quite sure, but check in. Make sure you've got your email address in ramdass.org where you get all this information and invites to all of the wonderful offerings that the Love Server Member Foundation brings to the table. So here we go. First up is Jack Kornfield, and then next week it'll be Sharon Salzberg's stories, and then end with Joseph Goldstein. So happy to share this with you. Thanks for being here. This is Mind Rolling on Be Here Now Network. Go to BeHereNowNetwork.com. Thank you. Hi, it's Raghu Marcus, and I am back. Thank God. Sharon Salzberg is here with me. Sharon, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, and I was just going to say, you know, one of the great things Sharon teaches is always remember you can return from wherever it is that you got lost in whichever way you might have gotten lost. And so the good thing is for me, I get to return with you on a fairly frequent basis, so it makes me happy, Sharon.
Yeah, not frequent enough. We should do this more often.
Yeah, well, we are. We are going to. Okay, so this is about our mutual love interest, Ram Dass. And sharing with me, of course, you and I have shared some of this over the many, many, many years. But for those, this is for those who haven't heard your particular story. Maybe you can start with, did you take a plane or a boat to India? How did you get there?
Neither. I went the classic way for those times. I took a plane to London, took the Orient Express train across Europe, and then went by bus and train and truck and God knows how. You know, it was like the overland route to India.
Were you alone?
No, I was with a small group of friends.
Oh. And
big journey. Yeah. I mean, I was 18 years old. I'd never even been to California before. Mm. I was a New Yorker, and I went to school in Buffalo, New York, and that was kind of it.
All right, then. Now, the interesting part is the people you met, I think, in what, Delhi? Did you meet some of the people?
What happened was I went with this kind of burning desire to learn how to meditate. And going to school in Buffalo, you know, 1970s, say, I looked around and I didn't see it anywhere because it wasn't anywhere that I could find. Mm. And I created this independent study project for the university asking to go to India and learn how to meditate. So they said, okay. So my urgent wish was for something really practical, very direct. I wanted to know the how-to. And it was really hard to find once I got to India. I didn't know where to go, for one thing. The story I tell, which is true, that in Buffalo, maybe 3 or 4 days before I was going to leave, Trungpa Rinpoche came to give a lecture, not at my university, but at another college in town. And I think it was his first trip to the States. I don't know who did his tour, you know, but he ended up in Buffalo, New York. And he asked for written questions at the end of his talk. So I wrote out the question, something like, in 3 or 4 days, I'm leaving for India to learn how to meditate. Do you have any suggestions about where to go? And he had this big pile of questions in front of him, and he pulled my question out and he read it out loud, and he was silent for a moment. And then he said, I think you had perhaps best follow the pretense of accident. Hmm. And that was it. I think you had perhaps best follow the pretense of accident. No monastery addresses, no handy guidebook, you know. Just follow the pretense of accident. That's exactly the way it happened. So we started out in Dharamsala once we got to India, all those many weeks later, because I knew the Dalai Lama lived there and I'd heard he was a Buddhist, you know, so I thought, oh, you know, and there was a great Lama teacher teaching meditation classes, but it was just one of those situations where something just doesn't work. Like I'd go to the class and they say, oh, the translator had to go to the dentist, who's at the other end of India, come back in 2 weeks. You know, so I'd come back in 2 weeks, and then Lama wasn't teaching. I mean, it just didn't happen. And so I was actually in a Tibetan restaurant in Dharamsala when I overheard a conversation about a Hatha Yoga conference that was going to happen in New Delhi. So I thought, oh, I'll go there. That's where I'll meet my teacher. So I went there, and it was like this absolutely dismal event where the low point was these yogis and swamis being up on the stage, pushing and shoving against each other to be the first to grab the mic and speak. So that was like totally desolating. But Dan Goleman, for some reason, I have yet to find out why, he was giving a paper. He was giving a talk at that conference. Hmm. At the time, he was a young graduate student studying meditation. And he gave a talk. And at the end of his talk, he said, you know, I'm going in a few weeks to this town called Bodh Gaya, where there's going to be this intensive 10-day meditation retreat. It's like an immersion course. Ram Dass is going to be there as a student. And I knew about Ram Dass because of my college, you know, like he came and gave a lecture or something like that. And he said, you know, this teacher who is S.N. Goenka is kind of famous for really emphasizing like the how-to. You know, it's very practical, very direct. And I had the thought, that's it. That's what I want. And it was exactly it. So Danny actually brought me to my first meditation retreat. And then still in New Delhi, same period, I had traveled with, you know, some people from Buffalo. And Mirabai Bush, at the time Linda, was a graduate student in Buffalo, and Krishna, her then husband at the time, John, was also in Buffalo, and they had gotten to India 12 hours before, something like that, and they spent the night in some hotel in New Delhi, slept, got up in the morning, walked outside, and these friends and I were there. And they recognized him, one of the guys, and they came up to him and said, aren't you from Buffalo? And he said, yeah. And he said, what are you doing? You know, we just got here. We said, oh, we're going to go to this meditation course in New Delhi, in Bodh Gaya. And they said, oh, maybe we'll go too, which was totally the magic of the time. It was all the pretense of accident.
Yeah.
You know, it was just like, oh, who do you run into?
Incredible. Wow. So there you are at the course in Bodh Gaya, and that's when you first met Ram Dass, right?
Mm-hmm.
What was that like?
is really interesting, you know, because Mirabai was there, then Linda Krishnadas was there, then Jeffrey. And Ramdas was there. He was already Ramdas. You know, he'd been to Indy before. He'd already been fired. He'd met Maharaji. He'd taken on this new role in life. And I realized that we treated him like the patriarch. He was the adult. You know, he was mature and he'd had a life. He'd done all these things. I was 18 years old. And looking back, it was so funny because I thought, oh, he was like 39 or something like that. We thought he's ancient, you know. Yeah. He was just like, and while we were there, the first box of Be Here Now arrived. You know,
Bindu so Dojas, actually.
We got to see it with him, you know, like the. And he was just like, those courses were not silent. They were silent days and silent periods, so we weren't actually breaking the rules, you know, but. We used to sit and just talk about things, you know, like the breath. It was all so simple in a way and so powerful because it was such a tremendous self-discovery. And, you know, so my first impression of him was probably he was extremely sophisticated compared to the rest of us.
But he had those eyes, right?
Even he had those eyes. He had that voice, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, and that caring is what, you know, I got when I first did. Was that there for you? Somebody who looked like they were caring more than about just themselves, perhaps?
You know, that's hard for me to say because I only cared about myself. You know? I guess probably because he was sort of further along. I mean, I had gone there because of significant psychological and emotional pain, you know, as did many of us. And so there wasn't really the room yet to, you know, there was a certain amount of healing that had to happen before there was enough energy to kind of notice, oh, there are other people. They're not doing that well either, you know. But I think that's a natural progression along the path of liberation.
Mm. And then, of course, after a few 10-day courses, there's the famous story which Joseph narrated a little bit when he was talking about his experiences. What was that whole thing, getting on that bus or not getting on that bus? And, what was that like?
Well, it was extremely intense altogether for us. You know, Goenka taught these 10-day retreats. And then maybe there'd be a 3 or 4 day gap before the next retreat. During one of those gaps, Danny went off to see the Kumbh Mela in Allahabad, you know, and came back. And then there was just another retreat. And during those courses, Goenka's teacher in Burma died. It was just like very intense, all of it. And at one point, there was this conversation with Ramdas and a group of people at the retreat about going to find Maharaji, going to find Nimkali Baba, and no idea where he was, you know. And for many of us, there was a choice point, you know, do you want to get on the bus and go touring around looking for him? Or do you want to stay and meditate or go somewhere else, you know, I suppose, because there were Tibetan teachers, there were so many teachers around. And I remember thinking, first of all, the practice was very profound for me and I wanted to continue doing it. But I also thought, I don't even know where he is. You know, like, I don't want to wander around India in a bus, you know, like looking for someone. They may never find him. Mm. So once I was teaching with Krishnadas and I said, how long was it? He said, oh, 10 hours. You know? So I was like, yeah, thank you. And I remember standing there waving goodbye to the bus.
Really?
You
know? Yeah. Wow.
I'm like, bye. Bye, guys. And the next time I saw everyone, you know, Jeffrey was Krishnadas and Linda was Mirabai. And I mean, Ramdas was still Ramdas.
And next time being with him would have been back in America, right?
I think it was America. And then... I came back in 1974. It was in Boulder then in 1974 because Joseph may have talked to you about this, but he really gave Joseph his first teaching job, which is at Naropa, and set Joseph on the course for the rest of his life, you know, and our lives. And I got to New York. Joseph had been back about 6 months already, and I knew he was in Boulder. And our joke was that of this sort of community of friends within the Buddhist circles in India, Joseph was the only one in America with a job and an apartment. So we all decided to go visit Joseph. And he was in some like really crummy student housing that Naropa was providing. And there's a one bedroom apartment, and literally at one point nine of us moved in and we're just like sleeping everywhere. And Ram Dass was there because Joseph was really his teaching assistant. Joseph apparently had stopped at the Naropa office, and he was traveling with some friends going cross country, and he had stopped there and said, you know, I lived in India for 7 years. My teacher told me to teach. I have just started teaching meditation and the Theravadan tradition, Southern Buddhist tradition. Would you like me to teach here in the summer? And they said, no. We already have Jack Kornfield. We don't need another Theravadan, when we didn't know Jack at the time. And so Joseph went on to Berkeley, where he ran into Ram Dass, who invited him to go to Naropa and be his teaching assistant. Yeah. So that's how Joseph started, you know. And so I was visiting Joseph, and he got invited to teach the next summer session, and I stayed on, became his teaching assistant. And then so that was the next time seeing Ram Dass, when he really crafted this life for us, you know, unbeknownst to everybody, by telling Joseph to teach and giving him a way to do it.
And you were at Naropa for the month, were you not?
Yeah, well, I was in there in the very beginning. I was there maybe, let's say, halfway through the first summer session, and then through the second summer session. And so I remember those mega courses, those classes that Ram Dass was teaching, you know, like 1,000 people on the Gita. And Joseph was teaching the little meditation subsection, and Krishna Dass was singing, teaching the chanting subsection. And he created a universe there, you know, which was really fantastic. And that really was the beginning for us. And so in 1976, we founded the Insight Meditation Society in Barrie, and Ram Dass was very instrumental in that as well. He had done courses with us in between, and I remember once he was at a course. I wasn't at that particular one. It was sort of like Jack and Joseph and I and a couple of other friends, and we teach in these different configurations, and this was a course with Jack and Joseph and maybe somebody else. Ram Dass sat it because he was like so beautiful that way. He would just like sit a course and not walk in like I'm a guru, you know. And he said something to Jack about it's interesting. He said something like, what you're doing is quoting the Buddha and quoting your teacher, quoting all these great saints. And I'm thinking, why am I sitting with you? You know, so which was actually, you know, a very powerful piece of advice, because in a way he was saying, you need to embody this and convey it. Otherwise you're referring people to other people, which in a way is humble, you know, and a good thing, but it also can be too much, because then it's just like you're not modeling sort of having embodied or lived those things. You're telling a story.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So back to Naropa for a second, though. Did you interact with Ram Dass at all at that time? Yeah.
And yeah, we were all, you know, we were all hanging out, and it was all, you know, it was such an unusual time. Like, you know, Allen Ginsberg would be by the pool, and Ram Dass was around, and it's the first place I ever saw Birkenstocks, the first place we ever heard of Celestial Seasonings tea, you know, because we've been out of America for a long time, and we weren't all sure what to expect. Like, coming back, it was pretty scary, actually.
You know? I remember.
And yet, here it was, just this world that got created, which was really far out.
Did you ever, were you around when any of the encounters with Trungpa Rinpoche and Ram Dass?
Yeah,
What was that like? I mean, I was too in another venue, not there, but on the East Coast. Yeah. But yeah. What was your take?
Well, my training at that point, you know, was much more kind of on Trungpa's wavelength, you know, emptiness and very kind of grounded. And Ram Dass was, you know, love and light, as we used to say.
As he used to say, Trungpa. Yeah. He called us all love and lighters. You.
Yeah. You know, and it was funny, though. You know, it was, like, extremely amusing. Like, when somebody asked Trungpa Rinpoche what he thought about Judaism, he said, oh, good food. You know, he was, like, very, very witty. And, you know, so the level of their discourse was really fun. Mm. And, you know, you go to one, and then you go to the other, and then you go to one, and then you go to the other, and then you hear, you know, what was going on. I mean, it's so funny because these days, all these years later, because we're talking 1974, the importance of holding both is so striking to me, you know, to sort of like look at the suffering and look at the difficulty and be grounded and look at the possibility, you know, and look at the potential that people have and, you know, the kind of, we would say from the Buddhist point of view, capacity, you know, other traditions might say divinity within, you know, and needing to hold both. And if you're only with the sort of painful reality, then you start to despair, you know, and if you're only with that potential and you're totally out of touch with the painful reality, you're just avoiding a lot, you know, and you're kind of ungrounded. So.
What did you see in Ram Dass? I mean, those talks were very powerful. I mean, we have all of them and we use them so much because they're so direct and they really represent, in my mind, heart and discriminating wisdom, basically, which all got embodied. And we'll talk about it later in Maui when Ram Dass was there and we join him every year. But did you see him in action in that time? Did you see all of that developing in terms of the kind of teaching that he did?
I think I did, in part because I've always thought of him as a phenomenal psychologist, you know, which I don't think he gets enough credit for. But he had a kind of very uncanny sensitivity to the human mind and the kinds of trouble we can get into and the ways we can hold on or cling. And I mean, I saw it over and over again where he could just like slice through, you know? So for all he talked of love and light, you know, and ascending and the divine, he never seemed to lose touch with the real angst. I wasn't about to say suris, but not everyone understands Yiddish, you know,
it's
the real angst
word,
that everyone goes through. Yeah. And it manifested later, is interesting enough, I'm just reflecting on it now for the first time. For somebody who was a love and lighter, you know, he was the first person I ever knew who worked with prisoners, worked with dying people. You know, he was not an avoidant kind of guy, you know, like, let me not pay attention to what's really hard.
Yeah.
It's quite the opposite.
Yeah. Yeah, very much so. So, okay, it rolls along 76, and that's when IMS started. And I do remember, I mean, that we all went down and started sitting courses then. But yeah, there's such an appreciation from the three of you, basically, Jack, Joseph, and yourself, of how he would come in and be, not be a somebody, even though he was pushed into that role so much by every. Did you see any of that or experience any of that when he would come to IMS or other people trying to grab him in that way and him having to deal with that? I know it was always very, very difficult for him.
Yeah, I mean, he was amazing. You know, he came for a long period. He was working on How Can I Help, I think. It was the book he was working on. So he basically did what we would call a self-retreat. There were retreats, programs coming and going, but he just basically lived here on retreat, pretty much on retreat, but he had this wig.
No.
For when he'd go out to dinner, you know, it was like really kind of like this big curly head of hair, you know, and, which was really always fun to try on. And sometimes people would, you know, they're quite overawed or tongue-tied, but he didn't seem to be buying into that. I mean, that's why he had the wig, you know, so it could be a normal, more normal person. And he was just there, you know, he was living there, working, or, you know, there are many times subsequent to that when, I know you seem to be wanting to go chronologically, but just skip ahead.
No, go ahead. There's no need for that.
You know, we were students together in Burma or in India. I went to some conference with the Dalai Lama in Dharamsala, and Ram Dass was there, not for that, but he was just there. And, you know, watching him take notes or things like that, I think, wow, you know, that's kind of incredible.
Hmm. Yeah, no, he was open. He was a student his whole life. It's but there was definitely a part where with us, I mean, this, I don't know if you even would have noticed, but with us meaning those that spent time with him, with Neem Karoli Bhatt, with Maharaji. And then, of course, when he was back teaching, especially in those years in the 70s going into the 80s, he was meeting so many people, and so many people became students, and so many people became friends, and so on, that he didn't want to give short shrift. I don't know where that word comes from. It's an interesting word. Mm-hmm. To the people he was now meeting, new people, in order to kind of be the friend that we had back in India, mm-hmm, and the mm-hmm. way in which he would interact with us and with Maharaji. I mean, you know, there's so much, like the famous story, of course, Krishnadas tells it wrong all the time, about me and asking how to meditate like Christ. He was lost in love with everyone.
That was everything. You?
That was me. You didn't know
I
that
didn't
you
know.
Know. Yes,
I never
you did.
Knew that.
You did, but he's drilled it in. You know, he's like that. He doesn't say it was him. Now he says that Canadian guy. That's what he says. He's so bad. but Ram Dass wasn't there that day, and he came back that night actually, and we told him what had happened. We're like, God, what? I mean, I was just looking for a mantra or something. You know, not that. Who could? Maybe you could talk to Maharaji because you have a more convivial sort of relationship, meaning I was scared shitless to say anything in that moment. I was so in awe of, you know, meeting somebody who was more like meeting a computer or something. It wasn't like there was a nothing in there. You know, talk about emptiness. We actually experienced that. But so Ram Dass said, fine, and he came, and he was the interlocutor for that particular experience. And he was that in many, many a time. But as time went on, it was a hard time. He used to have a bit of a time balancing the people like us that were, you know, stood naked together in front of that emptiness, shall we say, and then everybody was meeting after that. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's I'm sure extremely hard when there's that much projection at any rate, because you always probably feel you're failing. You know, you're not living up to the hopes and dreams and ideals of somebody. And I think that weighed on him, you know, for a while anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, it did. It did. You know. But he never veered away, as you said before, of difficulty.
Mm-hmm.
He just never did. And, you know, and we went through tough times at different times, old friends and him. But it was, I'm telling all these stories. You're supposed to be telling the stories, but
no, you have to inspire me.
I once was with him. We went out to lunch. This was in the late 80s, early 90s, something like that. And there was we used to see each other around the temple in Taos that was a definitive thing that always happened once or twice a year. And I remember I had lunch with him in Santa Fe, and I was bemoaning the fact that there was a real split going on in terms of the satsang around that Hanuman temple. People wanted it to be our kind of clubhouse, and then other people wanted just, hey, this is, we don't own anything here. So a lot of attention happened. And I was, Ram Dass and I were talking about it. And I said, geez, it would be so great if we could just come together and, you know, and not fight and be in that loving place that we have spent time with each other in days of yore. And Ram Dass said, you're a very romantic fellow now, aren't you? And yeah, and as you mentioned before, how astute he was around the psychology of the mind.
Yeah, he was so astute. He was really.
Yeah, and that was something.
He was just amazing.
I mean, I reflect on it more than I have reflected on it many a time over these ensuing many years that I have that thing in me. You know, I mean, we all do to some degree, wanting it all to be nice. And not getting into the woods, shall we say? All right. So then, I'm only going chronologically, just because it seems like an easier thing to do. But then, yeah. What about going into the 80s? And at that time, I know you were seeing him at different times and being with him. Do you recall? Mm-hmm.
I started sitting, and Joseph started sitting with his Burmese teacher, Sayadaw Pandita, in 1984. And there were a bunch of times that Ram Dass also came to sit with him in various places. I remember we were all in Hawaii together. We were all in Burma together practicing. And so it was like another venue. And then Ram Dass had to leave Burma pretty abruptly when his stepmother got sick. And he made this decision, and he knocked on my door, and he handed me like his stash of like M&Ms and, you know, like the things he had brought to sustain him because he was leaving and he didn't need them anymore. And I was staying, and I probably would. And Upandita had called me Santanandi, the bliss of peace.
That.
Yeah, it was nice. Yeah. And I have all these names I never use.
I'm calling you that from now on, Santanandi. Oh,
okay. And Ram Dass talked about that. He said, he was so funny. He said, Nandi, is that like Shiva's bull? You know, like, he was always trying to make that cross-cultural reference. Yeah. And he also had, I don't know if you experienced this, you know, some sense of, I mean, really, he was the epitome of a modern seeker. But it was almost more like he would say, I don't really have a lineage, you know, I don't have a, you know, because if you were like a Theravada Buddhist, you had, you know, those things. And if you were a Mahayana Buddhist, you had those things. If you were a Hindu, I imagine you have other things, you know. And so, and because Neema Karoli Baba was so open, you know, and transparent, and there was no thing, you know, like,
yeah,
we do this mantra, we do that mantra, you know.
No.
He always used to seem a little abashed, you know, like, I don't have a, you know.
Yeah.
Which, of course, it's like, that's true for all of us. We're all some combination of all these influences. And, but that would come up sometimes, you know, when we're in these situations.
Yeah.
And he was so, you know, practicing together, there's something that happens even in like that silence, you know, which is really extraordinary. When we were in Burma together in 1985, I was there for 3 months. It was my first really structured, guided experience of loving kindness meditation, of metta. And the way Upandita did what we call interviews, these short meetings with people where he'd hear about your practice and then give you some feedback. We were seeing him 6 days a week. The way he did that was he had this kind of like living room and he'd be at one end of it. And the person who was describing their practice would be sitting on the floor right in front of him. And if it was your turn next, you'd be waiting in the back of the room. So there was a kind of seamless flow going forward. So the sequence was Ram Dass, Joseph, and me. And Ram Dass was really interested in me because I was doing loving kindness practice, which very few people did in a formal way in those days. And so he said he used to wait in the back of the hall, pretending to be taking notes on everything Upandita had told him as a direction, so he could wait through Joseph and then hear me.
Mm,
you know, and so I hear Joseph. I never went early enough to hear Ram Dass, but I did hear Joseph for 3 months. And, you know, so it's an incredible way to bond because you're so revealed and to your teacher, and you can't really say, could you get rid of the guy in the back, you know, like, before I tell you this, you know, and and everyone's practicing, and it's quite beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then, moving into, the big event in Ram Dass's life, his stroke in the mid-90s. Do you remember where you were when you found out? And
I remember exactly where I was. I was here in Barry teaching. And Mirabai happened to be sitting that retreat. So I pulled her out of retreat. And we basically kind of did a vigil. And I was working on, or certainly thinking about, this book called Faith, which I wrote. Ram Dass's stroke and that night figures in the book because I saw the difference between, we could say, you know, in Buddhist language, we'd say the difference between hope and faith, the difference between attachment and faith. You know, it was sort of like we all wanted so much for him to be well and be, as I put it, better than he was before, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's a human response. I mean, of course we want that. But when that becomes this kind of attachment or rigidity, then it was like, what if he doesn't get well? Do I abandon him? Do I not like him anymore? Is that not good enough? Mm. And as compared to what I was calling faith, which was basically accompanying him throughout whatever his journey was going to look like without my own needs for, you know, that reassurance to be predominant. And I learned a lot just watching my own mind in that period.
Maybe you could write a book, Wise Faith, by the way.
Yeah, that might have been a better title, actually, to begin with. Maybe I can retitle it.
Yeah, well, it's like that thing we did a few weeks ago, Wise Hope. When did you see him first after the stroke?
I went to visit him in California where he was living. So some months later, he was out of the hospital, out of rehab. And that's in my book too, actually. I walked into the house. I was the only visitor at that point. And the living room was piled high with things people had sent him, you know, like herbs and concoctions and this and that. Which is a beautiful gesture of how important he was in so many people's lives. But sometimes from those messages, you could also tell there was something else going on. Like, take 15 drops of this and you will definitely be walking again in 2 weeks. And I think, wow, you know, the internal experience of getting a message like that might actually be pressure. You know, like, what if it doesn't happen? Are you gone? What if I disappoint you and I'm not walking? Is that okay? So like, where's the love, you know? So the day I was there, he got a bottle of Ganges water with one of those messages, like take 15 drops of this and you'll definitely be walking again in 2 weeks. And I said, don't drink that. Whatever you do, don't drink it. You'll end up with cholera if you drink that. You know, and then I saw him a bunch in the months later, you know, as he was, we started doing these retreats as kind of fundraisers for him, like at Omega and other places. And it was also an interesting time, a powerful time, because he was trying to take back agency and basically control in his life, as one might, you know, after a devastating incident like that, but also didn't have the capacity to actually do everything he'd once done. And so we were teaching once at Omega together, one of these benefit retreats, and they put us, they have a lake, you know, and they put us by the lake on this platform, and there was an incline, you know, like a ramp up to the platform in the back, so like facing the lake, for him to go up in his wheelchair. And I'm sitting on a chair, and he's sitting on the wheelchair, and he's wheeling as he's speaking, back and forth and back and forth. And people were petrified. He was going to like wheel right down in the back and fall in the lake. And I could just see it, you know, like, ah. And then finally, Gelug Rinpoche, who's this very esteemed Lama, who's also on the faculty teaching this benefit retreat, came up to my chair and crouched down next to me and started whispering, "He's going to fall in the lake." You know, so Ramna said, "What's going on? Like, why are you whispering?" And his attendant at the time brilliantly stood up and said, "Everyone is afraid you're going to fall into the lake. Do you want to put the brakes on, or do you want me to tell them to stop worrying?" And Ram Dass thought for a moment to put the brakes on.
When you mentioned, you know, hearing about the stroke and then seeing him and then all the people sending stuff to say, okay, do this and you'll be well, and what if he's not well, and so on. And the reality that we speak of so much, and I know you've heard Krishnadas talk about it, Ram Dass became who he was pointing to as a result of this, which is incomprehensible, because I was real privy to the amount of pain and suffering. And I have never seen anybody, I mean, you know, Jack likes to use the phrase, make friends with suffering. Well, all you all Buddhists, you like to make that. I think it's a fabulous expression. I've never seen anybody do it but Ram Dass.
Yeah.
I mean, where I knew he was doing that, it was an everyday thing, because every day there was some more, another expression of some kind of pain or suffering, sometimes small, sometimes large. It's really staggering. I mean, I'm sure you saw it. So of somebody who was able to transcend this and be there for people on top of it all. I mean, it's one thing to transcend it and have your life and so on, and but not dealing with hundreds of people, et cetera, et cetera. So then
it was amazing, you know. It was just like sometimes in those retreats in Maui, where all these people would come up to him, as you know, during the meal, like, "Can I have my photo taken with you?" or just to talk to him. And I think, why is he eating with everybody? You know, like, you know, he's so tired, and it's so hard, and I can barely handle it, you know. Like, but there he was, you know, far better than I. Like, if you tried to get him to withdraw more, he didn't like that, you know. He was there for the people. And I wondered, I don't know what you think about this, but one of the times we were in Maui together, he gave this talk, and he was talking about receiving help. And he said that after the stroke, it was the hardest thing of all, harder than the pain, harder than the aphasia, you know, or being in a wheelchair. Like, actually receiving help, he said it was the hardest thing of all, and it was the most liberating. And he went on to say that, you know, of course, one of his famous books was How Can I Help? And he said, maybe I should write a book called How Can You Help Me? And I wondered if that ability to actually receive made him just so transparent, so that the love was going both ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, there was no more blockage anywhere because he was just like made of light and love, which was remarkable.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And the other thing you must comment on is all those years that started, God, I don't know, 2006 or something, where we started doing retreats and you started coming out, and all those years. And the way that that happened was like a full circle of all of us meeting. And I say that generally. I mean, I didn't meet you in India. I met you in America. I did meet Joseph, though, at the course that I went to. And yeah, the full circle nature of the way in which this was set up by the universe, to have that blending of this incredible practice of Vipassana, and beyond that, really mm-hmm. dealing with impermanence and emptiness, and which was combined with that love and light, if we want to say. You know, which is a denigrating thing, but in reality, Ram Dass had that balance. And that balance got manifested by virtue of all of us being together in the way that we were all those years. It's pretty powerful, no?
Very much so.
Hmm.
So that's why he was the example of something that really became prevalent, you know, became much more cohesive. You know, and he would fret that he didn't have a lineage, but in fact, it was the lineage. It's like I said to somebody about myself the other day, I said, because I'm on Twitter like all the time, and I said, you know, I know a tiny amount about an enormous range of subjects because I learn everything from Twitter. And they said, oh, you have a modern mind. You know?
That's cool.
So he, in a very much deeper way, he had sort of a modern spirituality. This is what it actually looks like.
Yeah, yeah. And he was able to pretty much, without exception in terms of what I saw, be with people and respond to people from where they were on all of the planes. The psychological plane, the spirit plane, soul plane, true nature plane, emptiness plane, love plane. I mean, where anybody was at, he could respond. And that is rare, really. And I think it is a reflection of the lineage that he thought he didn't have, you know, which is to absolutely. The first second we were with Maharaji, there's only one sub-ek, you know, that teaching. And that's pretty much the lineage. The way in which we all were pushed over by an unseen force to Vipassana. Right, and that got integrated with further with Tibetan practice and Tibetan teachers, which all you guys have been with, you know. So there's a way in which your openness encompasses that as well, mm-hmm. which I guess is part of what allows for this blend to have happened over all these years. And we have, that's pretty. That's pretty graceful. It really is. And So last but not least, I guess whatever Ram Dass meant to you in the deepest part of your growth, your friendship, the love that you shared, where does that all sit with you now? Of course, he's gone almost a year.
Well, has it been almost a year?
Yeah, it's going to be, you know, amazing. A few months.
It's just amazing.
Yeah.
Well, I keep thinking about him as a pioneer. Like I said, he was the first person I ever knew who was working with prisoners, the first person working with homeless people, the first person working with dying people. And, you know, his message really seemed to be no one should be forgotten. And this is as spiritual as anything you can do, you know? And I think he's the most profound symbol of that in my life, you know, that I reflect on.
Nobody should be forgotten. That's beautiful. And really, the way I relate with it is that first minute that I saw him was a big moment of presence, because of the way that he could just embrace you, and there was nothing else going on, not even Richard or Ram Dass was going on. It was just in the embrace. And the most telling thing, when I said to him once, actually in the last couple of years, you know, Maharaji told you not to say a word about him in America. Full, I knew, he knew, everybody knew that was a gaffe. You know, Maharaji was playing and having a good time. He knew exactly what was going to happen. But what was going on inside your head, Ram Dass, that you know, you did not follow that instruction, to say the very least? And he said, well, I couldn't not share it. How could I? It was a jewel. How could I not share that jewel? That's exactly what he said. And that is what happened over this span of many, many decades. And and after the stroke, that the jewel he was sharing became inimitable with himself, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And yeah, we were all the recipients of it. And the kind of sharing, I'm thinking that, you know, we're going to have to try and do one more something in Maui just to honor, you know, what happened over those years. God willing, we don't know what's going on any level now. Talk about real change, the book you just wrote.
Mm-hmm.
And making friends with that. This is a time for it. But I just look back and the way that we came together, and you know, you were there from the very, very, you were the first person that came from our Buddhist close ones, you and Jack and Joseph. And of course, Roshi Halifax is there as well. I don't know. How the hell you can repeat that one? This is kind of what I think. Yeah. All right. Any last anecdote, and that's it. Any anecdote, whatever, any time frame, doesn't matter, that touched you just in a moment.
Oh, okay. When Ram Dass was living in that kind of guest house on Larry and Girish's property in, was it Mill Valley? We're in Marin County.
Yeah.
And we were visiting him once, and Joseph and I, and he was sort of like, you know, I'm just like really tired of people. I'm really tired of...
This is pre-stroke or post-stroke?
This is pre-stroke.
Pre-stroke, right.
You know, he said, I'm really tired of people. I'm really tired of, like, you know, having to take care of people. I'm really tired of, you know, the whole thing. So I'm just going to have fun with you guys. We're just going to play, and you know, it's just going to be like a great weekend or something like that. And then his phone rang and he didn't pick it up. He let it go to voicemail or answering machines or whatever we had in those days, you know. But we could hear the message, you know. So somebody, we could hear this woman's voice, and she was saying, you know, I feel really odd that I contacted you, and, you know, I didn't mean to intrude, but, you know, I've been having such a hard time, and I don't know if I can go on. And his hand went out so fast and picked up that phone and just started talking to her.
Mm. Right after,
you know,
that.
And it was like after that whole preamble of like, I'm tired, you know, like, it was just like, it was so fast.
Yeah.
There he was.
I mean, boy, oh boy, oh boy, as he used to say, it's not something you can think about anything. You know, it's so deep. It's so deep inside him for all those years. It's just amazing. You know, just amazing. Wow, that's so great. Thank you. Well, thanks for the time, Sharon. And
thank you,
everybody. We will probably see you soon on the Be Here Now Network. This is Raghu and Mind Rolling, and thank you again, Sharon.
Thanks so much.
Bye bye.